So sometimes I will ask, what's the worst question you could ask a driver right after a session? And they'll be thinking about that for a while, and I'll say, any question.
Welcome to the Your Data Driven Podcast. If you like this podcast, be sure to visit our website at yourdatadriven.com for more useful help and advice on setting up your race car, mastering data analysis, and driving faster. Welcome to episode 37. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Jim Kearney to the show. Jim is a US-based driver coach who's had an amazing amount of success helping drivers improve and win, particularly at events such as the runoffs in America. If you're not sure what a driver coach can offer you, or want to learn Jim's secret sauce top tip that any driver can use to improve, then this show is for you. It was a fascinating conversation with Jim, and I'm sure you'll get a lot out of it. So, as always, grab a pen, grab a coffee, sit back, and let's enjoy what Jim has to say. You may know that at the end of season one, I wrote the Motorsports Playbook, a summary distilling the first 20 shows into nuggets of wisdom. I made the notes so that you don't have to. If you've not got it yet, go and grab yourself a copy from the website. So, Raoul, welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Samir. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's so nice of you to join us. I'm really genuinely excited about this conversation and where it's going to go. You've worked in motorsport and racing for some period of time as both a competitive driver and coach. So it would be lovely to explore some of your experiences for people listening and maybe work towards maybe one or two takeaways or one of those lessons learned that you've picked up over the years that you think, you know what, people never do that and they should probably do that, with obviously without giving all the trade secrets away, but just for the benefit of people listening so that they can go away and think, yeah, I'll give that a go. So how does that sound?
Happy to do it.
Tell us a bit about you. Who are you? What you're doing? What's your experience in racing? And what brings you to the show today?
Well, I got started in racing a long time ago. I didn't live all that far from Watkins Glen. And as a bunch of young kids, we were motivated to go to New York because then you could possibly buy beer. And that was a big motivator, of course. But when I got to Watkins Glen, I was stunned by the experience. I was just bowled over. It was like I had grabbed the third rail or something. You know, I didn't understand it then what the attraction was, but I knew I had to have more of it, you know. And is it back in those days, and this would have been probably in the mid-60s, how far back it goes, there wasn't ready access to driving schools or even information about driving. I'm not so sure I could have done anything about it anyway, because I didn't have two nickels to rub together. But I became a fan, and it was my sport of choice, so to speak, and followed it, you know, pretty religiously and went to races. And it really never occurred to me during this maybe 15-year period that I could somehow, you know, actually get behind the wheel.
What was it that attracted you to the sport? Because I think a lot of people listening will be like nodding and stuff. But what is it that you think worked? I mean, for me, it was the smell. There was something about four-stroke petrol and the speed and the exhilaration and the noise and just the whole theatre of the whole thing that's really got me stuck onto it. So what was it? Can you remember like what it was? Because it becomes a habit and then you never question it again, you know?
I've thought a lot about that. I remember, my dad would give me these little race car toys, and things that happen, I think, sometimes with your parents, you're not even really aware of. But I could tell that driving a car, and they knew nothing about racing, but I could tell that driving a car for him was an important thing. I mean, he paid a lot of attention to it. He would talk about it. And when he, went through my driver's license and my dad sat in the other seat and kind of swaggered me in the process of just driving on the street, I could tell that this was an important task. You needed to pay attention to it and do it right. And the other piece for me was I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania, a town called Dunmore, right alongside Scranton. And of northeastern Pennsylvania, there was one sport that mattered, and that was football, you know, U.S. football. Nothing else mattered. They had other sports, and yeah, they mattered a little bit, but U.S. football was it. And so I repeatedly went out for football, oblivious pretty much of the fact that I was one of the smallest kids in high school. I mean, I grew to a normal size later, but I just couldn't do what I wanted to do competitively. And I think when you're a kid, you're kind of thinking, well, everybody's like me. I mean, I didn't, there was no way for me to realize that my competitive needle was, you know, at 100 or turned up to 11 or whatever you might say. You just thought, well, everybody feels the same way. But I was incredibly competitive, and I had no real outlet for it because I couldn't make the damn football team. And one of the things that did occur to me when I went to Watkins Glen is that these people were competing like crazy, and some of the people that got out of the cars were quite small. And I remember thinking, you know, you know.
There's two ticks here. Yeah, there's two ticks. It's like, oh, as a sport I'm made for, horse racing or driving a car.
And about all those things that you counted and impressed me as well. The sound, the beauty, the smells, the danger, the clear competitiveness. It was just fascinating. And about that time, of course, I get issued a driver's license. So when I can take my parents' car or my sister's car and go out on the country roads, I would do the best I could to try to figure out what's the right way to do any of this stuff. And really back then, again, I sound like talking from the 1800s or something, but back then there really wasn't any information that I could access. I would read Road and Track or Car and Driver or Sports Car Graphic, and they would talk about a four-wheel drift, but they never said what the hell it was really. And so I'd be out there in my sister's Pontiac trying to figure out, well, what happens if I do this or what happens if I do that? And so I think one of the things that has really helped me both in driving and in coaching later is that I started from such a blank slate, you know? I mean, I just didn't know anything at all. And so I connect with basics, I think, you know? I just kind of remember that feeling of almost like a, you know, massive amounts of desire and connecting with it like crazy, but simply not knowing how to do the dance step. You know, it's like, how do I do what, you know, what's better? Or, you know, I just didn't have a clue. And so that it really kind of, I think, does help me connect with people because I'm not assuming at any stage that they should know this or they should know that.
There's something about motorsport and this attitude towards this kind of macho thing, like gladiatorial thing, like who trains the gladiator type thing. It's that, you know, they work it out for themselves. And I don't know where it's born from, fighter pilots or something like that from a different age where literally they were thrown in a plane and had to work it out sort of thing. And they brought some of that to car racing and driving cars when they got back. I don't know what the history is really, but it's like you say, it's you just got to throw yourself in there and it either like becomes something you want to do or it's just not for you. And I think it's quite polarizing actually in a way. You either get sucked in and you can't, and then that's it for life, which is what's happened to me. or it's just like, you just don't get it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I feel pretty strongly about is that it's a real shame when I see somebody who is attracted to it for whatever reason and then doesn't have any help or get the right help in terms of figuring out how to do it better. And I think that can happen, you know, really easily.
I've seen that happen a lot, and it's frustrating.
I mean, if you go to an art show, everyone will look around and say, "Is everything is really good." But if you go to a, you know, a race track or a track day, there's a sheet or there's a, you know, a list that's posted, and, you know, it's not everybody's equal. It's, you know, you suck, because you're way down here on the list and you feel bad about that. And unless you can figure out a way to start marching up the list, you might come to the conclusion pretty early on, like, this just isn't for me. And, you know, I think there's certainly going to be people who, you know, decide that this isn't for me. But I'm really overwhelmingly impressed by the number of people that if you stick with it and start to apply yourself, you can get so much better at it. And as you get better at it, even if it's incrementally, you feel terrific about it. You know, you feel like, yeah, I love this sport. And yeah, there's maybe a place for me in it, damn it. And I'm getting a little bit better. And if you stay focused, I think, on yourself and driving your car a little bit better, the whole experience is so much more fun and it's powerful.
So one of the things I've heard you say before, and I just love this phrase, it's that the fact that you might not be at the front, but if you feel like you're improving, that's fun. And one of the things, I've had a lot of people on this show talking about the psychology of drivers and you know, what's a win for you, trying to redefine what success looks like so that we can actually, ironically, get to the front, or at least just have fun, even if you don't compete. And the lap time isn't the only be all and end all. It's your progress. And I love that phrase that you were saying there. It's just like, yeah, okay, just remember that. So it's about setting those expectations. And I think with what you're saying about coaching and or just support around you, having the ability to create, well, let's see where you actually are. And then, okay, your goal for today is to do X and you've done that. Forget about everyone else. that will come out in the wash, kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I've seen people go through that. I mean, I've seen people go through that where they are, you know, kind of feeling stuck mid-pack or back, you know, back further than mid-pack. And really, on one level, settling for that quite happily. They're so happy to be there. They want to participate. But at some point, they might start to kind of, you know, raise their head up a little bit and kind of say, I wonder if this is where I'm destined to be, so to speak, or whether I could do a little bit better. You know, I think applying themselves in a real, real simple, simplistic fashion actually can be the best thing for them. I think that, you know, our sport is soaked with complexity. You know, if you talk about any aspect of the car, you can just lose your mind. You know, it's, everything is a rabbit hole, shocks and tires and, you know, chassis and, you know, it goes on and on. And you think like, well, I need to go back and become an engineer before I can even run another lap.
As an engineer, it's still completely terrifying. it's like you scratch the surface a little bit and you go, right, okay, I think I've got a bit better understanding. And then you're off down another little rabbit hole and you're just like, oh, that's really hard.
the cars are incredibly complicated, but driving them a little bit better isn't complicated, which is not to say it's easy. But I find if I take an actual whiteboard and hand it to the guy or the gal and say, write down three things that you want to do this session. Your words, you know, you pick. And then after the session, you know, in addition to doing the track map, which is the cornerstone of everything that I do, at some point when we're done with our conversation, they look at the whiteboard, you know, and it's really, really basic. And by asking them to write down these three things, it frees them, I think, from obsessively running this list, this to-do list that the left brain has. I have to do these 47 things right. I want to do these 47 things right. But if they think like, okay, three, I can do three, it just puts them in a different frame of mind. And I think that, you know, the driver going out on track, you had mentioned the word feeling supported. To me, that's the absolute key. If the driver thinks like, well, okay, person is here helping me some, and we've got a plan, and the plan is not something that's mystifying to me. You know, he asked me to write down three things and I'm doing them. And I'm going to go out there and try to enjoy myself. And I think that that's the other key. I worked with this great young gal. She's not quite so young now, but still pretty young, Megan Gilkes, who went on to the W Series. And we just, because she was so young, she was 16 when I started working with her, and she was small. And I remember thinking, gosh, you know, how can I assure her? Turns out she didn't really need a lot of that, but we kind of did this routine anyway. The first thing I would do is I'd stand in front of her, the nose of her Formula V before she'd go on track, and I'd wiggle my fingers. And that was the reminder to keep her hands soft, because if your hands are soft, and your arms are more likely to be supple, that means your imports can be smooth instead of ratchet. The other thing I'd do is I would point towards the sky. And that was that I wanted her to feel like a kid on Christmas morning. Every time she gets in the car about to go out, I want her to feel like she was a kid waking up on Christmas morning thinking, wow, this is going to be great. This is so wonderful that I get to do this. And I can remember myself, you know, going through long periods where I would be pissed off at myself. I would be, you know, just pushing myself so hard, dissatisfied with my performance, angry out of, you know, stupidity. And it was just all of these thoughts are not conducive to a good performance. And so kind of getting that connection back to, this is great that I'm able to do this. And then finally release the left brain to-do list and think like just one thing to do now, which is to go out there and perform. Simple, simple, simple.
I love it. So let's roll back. You mentioned your racing because you haven't just been a coach. So tell us a bit more about your career in the sport.
Well, when I finally started to do something kind of actually driving competitively, what led to that was I had bought a secondhand Lotus Europa and drove it on these back roads in the area where I ended up living most of my life, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Saw an article in the newspaper, oddly enough, about a giant section of the county that had no police enforcement other than state police once a month would like roll through these townships. I couldn't believe it. So I remember posting that on my wall, and I went and worked out a 13.2-mile loop that I would run. And, you know, it was, I tried to not to be a complete idiot about it. And it's like, you know, kids, don't try this at home, because clearly it wasn't an advisable thing to do. But I would just run the car, and I would hang a stopwatch around my neck. So if I ever got in trouble, I was completely screwed. And racing, because the pedals were small. But I would just try things, you know. And yeah, I didn't crash the car, which is kind of amazing in retrospect. And about that time, Bill Scott Racing had a Solo One school, and you could do that for $50. So I remember thinking, well, even I have $50, and went there, and it went amazingly well. I just felt at home. I felt at ease. I got some instruction from a Bill Scott Racing instructor, Nikki Kozlov, who was racing Formula Fords and Nationals. So he was a godlike figure to me. And he was pleasantly impressed with my driving. And all of this was just like, it was like a movie scene for me, you know, to actually be there with other, you know, drivers. And some of them had real race cars and driver suits and that kind of stuff. And to me, it was just, I just wanted to drive the car. It was like an unbridled thirst, you know. It's like pictures of guys crawling across the desert looking for water or something. I just wanted to drive the car so much. At the end of the day, there was this, like a little mini keg party. You could do that back then. 50 people having a beer or two. And I remember seeing, you know, Bill Scott walking by. And I remember kind of thinking like, wow, that guy is actually a race driver. You know, he's actually a race driver. And he was walking through the crowd, and he came over to me and he shook my hand. And he said, it would be a shame if you didn't race. And I don't remember what I said. I probably said homina, homina. But it was staggering to me. It was just like an otherworldly type of experience. And I got back in touch with him, and knocked him down a few dollars on his driving school. And I went to his driving school, and, you know, that had kind of a similar feel to it. It just felt like I had almost a natural aptitude for it. But I think in retrospect, all these years when I was trying to figure out, you know, I was going to races and watching these people, whenever I'd get an opportunity to drive anybody's car, you know, I would go off into these, you know, different areas and drive through, you know, logging roads or country roads, or just, I was always kind of trying to just kind of figure stuff out. So I think when I finally got back, I had actually probably, maybe I had my 10,000 hours in and I didn't realize it, you know, but that connected me with racing. And I ended up, you know, renting a Formula Ford. It was the only Formula Ford race I ever drove in my life, and finished fourth out of 44. And then I got a bill after that, of course, and I realized, well, this is not something I can continue with. So I ended up buying an old Formula V, and that was in many ways good, but now I was preparing my own car. And I knew nothing. I was like the, you know, the woman who gets home from the hospital with her first baby. You know, I knew nothing. And it took me a number of years to kind of sort that through. But I gradually did start to, you know, figure out car carrying and feeding. And things gradually, you know, got better. And I started to do well, you know, in Formula B. And so there's a couple other, you know, cars that I drove, but really the great majority of it is like 98% of it was Formula B stuff. And that was actually in many ways good because I could, quote, afford it. If I did all the work myself, other than the motors and the transmissions, I could afford to field a pretty good car and compete, you know, with the best in the US.
Yeah, so the Formula V is such a great platform for racing, and still is to this day. So at what point did you transition from sort of racing yourself to then more recently you've been helping drivers? Because again, that's not a natural progression for everyone. I don't think people who've raced or drive well, particularly, you know, it's not a logical next step for many people. So what was it that appealed to you, and what, you know, what is a coach in your mind, and why was that something that you wanted to pursue?
Well, I had used a coach myself on a couple of occasions, and I was really fascinated by it. It was that feeling of being supported, and I just thought, like, this is great. I couldn't afford it, but I was fascinated by it, and I ended up writing a couple of articles about it in Sports Car Magazine, and they almost surprised me when I came across them a few years later, because I never really thought about coaching anybody else. I just wanted them, people or friends or coaches, to, you know, help me. I was like the typical selfish racing bastard that was just kind of like, help me, you know, what can it do for me? What can it do for me? What can it do for me? And there would be a couple of my friends that I raced with who we would kind of actually talk about, you know, the actual driving. It's so much of the conversation was about the care and feeding of the car. And if you're at any given paddock, it seemed like everyone, you know, again, these are club racers, so they're mostly taking care of their own cars, if not by themselves, with one or help of another person or two. But all they're talking about is the car. And a couple of my friends, I thought, we would discuss actually driving the damn cars, and we kind of coached one another very informally. It wasn't until I stopped racing that I was selling my equipment to various other Formula B drivers that I knew, and they would comment about how much I had, thanking me for how much I had helped them with their racing. I had really had no idea what they were talking about. I thought they were just being polite. I thought they were being nice. You know, they felt bad that I was leaving the sport, and gosh, let's say something nice to Jim. And it was about the fourth guy in a row that had made that comment. And he had kind of said something along the lines of, no, you need to understand, you can put it into words that we can do something with. These other drivers are quick too, but I can talk to them all day and I have no idea what they're saying. You can put it in words. You should be an instructor. And he got kind of in my face a little bit. And he's such a mild-mannered guy, Ray Qualls, wonderful guy. You know, on the way home, I remember thinking, you know, I don't want to be an instructor. I mean, it's pleasant to do that chore a little bit, but it wasn't something that I felt was going to get me out of bed, so to speak. But that's when the thought first hit me, like, well, maybe I should try doing this driver coaching thing. And I called four guys who I knew in Formula V. It was about a month before the runoffs, and said, it was like the worst sales call ever. Said, I'm thinking about doing this. I don't know if you would be interested in it. And if you were, I don't know what I'd charge you. But think about it, and I'll call you back in a week. And all four said yes. So I thought maybe that's an indicator. And so we went off to Road America, great place. And one of the guys, Rick Shields, who has been to the runoffs, to say six prior occasions with the best finish of ninth, won the race. He was national champion. And a couple of days later, he was selected the most improved driver in the country.
Wow. For the benefit of people listening, it's something that was new for me as well at the end of last year. So what's the runoffs? And because I think it's quite a unique event, and I don't think many people have heard of it outside of North America, maybe.
Yeah, it's kind of like our equivalent of the Formula Ford Festival. I mean, that's kind of the way we look at it in the States, I think. Basically, you know, you will compete all year long in a division, Northeast Division or Southeast Division, and you'll try to, you know, do as well as you can there. I won the Northeast Division four times, and I'm very proud of that, of course. But it really didn't seem to be nearly as big a deal as the runoffs. And the runoffs is you invite all the people from the different divisions who have qualified, and that's changed some, but to one winner-take-all race, and they drag it out, I think, in a pleasant way, although it drives a lot of people crazy. You'll be there for like maybe 10 days.
Yeah, this is what I discovered. It's like, how long has this been? It's like well over a week.
That alone is an important component of the runoffs, is keeping your head throughout such a long period of time.
So here we go. So I've got one for you. So this is on my question list. Number one on my question list, actually. So what is the secret to winning the runoffs in a Formula V?
I think you have to race hard all year long. You know, you can't just get focused on this one race. You've got to be at the height of your driving combativeness. You've got to be ready to be in this scrum that's going to last a number of days and keep your head throughout it. So you really do have to have a plan with motors, not one motor. You got to have a plan with tires. You've got to have everything kind of planned out and different possibilities and be playing your cards in such a way that you can place your car repeatedly, session after session, towards the front six, let's say, or eight. And then you've got to keep your cool through the race. Because at some point in time, there's a danger of a breakaway. And if you're not at the right end of the breakaway, you're now fighting to be king of the second brigade. And it's quite difficult, I think. People have made a lot of noise about the fact that it's much easier these days to qualify for the runoffs. And I think that is true. But to be there and be successful in almost any definition at the runoffs in any class is still incredibly hard. To be in the top, you know, half of the field is really difficult, let alone be at the front.
So one of the things that was a new thing for me as well was the radios. So I think that's quite common. So in the UK here, and I don't know in other parts of the world, but we don't have radios in amateur racing. Certainly at the Formula V level. What I thought was fascinating was the whole, you've got spotters and you've got people talking to each other, and even your teammates could effectively talk to each other in the race on the radio. So you can work out your own team tactics actually during an event. And I was just like, this is quite something else. It's a whole new dimension. So is that, I mean, what's your thoughts on that? Is that something that sort of has always been there, or it's come in and, you know, it adds to the event?
You know, I think you'll find that there's probably been like bar fights about this, you know, about what's the right way to do it and what's the wrong way to do it. And I was always considered myself extremely fortunate if I had somebody, you know, giving me a lap count as opposed to talking to me a lot. It was, that's kind of the way that I grew up with it. So I would say most of the time that I was racing in my first, you know, 10 years, there was no radio at all. And so maybe that makes me view the radios differently because that's what I came up with. Now, they can be a huge help in a number of different ways. But again, I tend to look at them, again, as simply as possible. I don't like to do a lot of talking on the radio to drivers, and I didn't like being talked to a lot either. But I've seen people go both ways on that. And I think it's just, it's one of those things that one of the things I've felt like I've learned through coaching is that everybody is different. Everybody is dramatically different. And it's, you know, sometimes I jokingly say it's amazing that we're all considered the same species. You know, we're just so dramatically different in what we want. And what I want in a race car is kind of like a, almost like a Kimmy thing, you know, it's just like, leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. It's really more a matter of, I feel like I'm busy that I need to focus on this. But I have found on both ends of it that a little bit of information can be hugely helpful. What I have found with drivers that a fellow once asked me, he was having problems with a slow turn 7 at Road Atlanta. Because it's a slow turn, and sometimes it's difficult for the drivers to discern how they're doing. In a fast turn, you kind of think like, gosh, you know, I think I nearly, you know, I saw Jesus there on exit, so I must be doing it okay. But on a slow turn, you have no idea, right? And so I went down there, and on the way down there, I was trying to figure out what's the best approach. And I came up with an approach that, again, it's simple as can be. And I've stayed with, I said, if, you know, if I see a good segment, I'm going to say the word good. If during the session you do a segment that's better than that, I'm going to say better. And if during the session you do the, you know, to date the best segment, I'm going to say best. So it's good, better, best. That's all they need to hear in my mind as they exit a turn, you know, at the end of the, you know, track out, for example, and it's sometimes amazing to them how an approach that or a segment that they ran felt slow to them was actually best on the watch.
Talking of the sort of what everyone's different, talking of that kind of idea, the other thing that came to my mind was the role of data. And you've obviously seen that come in through your career. So where does data fit in terms of your coaching? How do you use it? Do you use it? Is it something that you find adds value or doesn't add value as a distraction? You know, what's your thoughts on using data to try and help drivers?
It's not my go-to place in terms of the traditional use of the word data. What I will do, in every session, I'm out at a turn that we consider important. Oftentimes, I'll just ask the driver, where do you want me? I do have a deep feeling that drivers kind of have a sense of what they need, but they don't know how to do something about it. So they'll select a turn, I'll go to it, and I will do segment times with a handheld stopwatch, but I will also connect with, say, a couple of other drivers in the class. Maybe it's somebody that they feel that they should be running as well as, or maybe it's the top drivers. But after each session, after they do the track map, we have a conversation about that. When we get to that corner, I can show them exactly, you know, because my watch allows me to record it afterwards and write down the numbers and show them, okay, here's what, you know, the top guy in the class was running. Here's what you are running. And I found that to be, it sounds incredibly, you know, basic, but I found that to be of incredible value to drivers. Sometimes they will be impressed by how close they are in some turns, and sometimes they can see clearly exactly how far off they are. As both of those pieces of information are incredibly practical and incredibly, I think, useful to them. And in follow-up sessions, they can get closer and they can see exactly how much closer they're getting.
I think your point there is really important, in the sense of, even if you're not that, no slower than the fast guy, that's actually reassuring as well. So you don't get into a situation where the driver could be overdriving or such like. So the data can be used to help you find opportunities, but equally to help you reassure yourself that, yeah, you're basically getting the maximum out of the car right now in this area. You know, the focus possibly needs to be somewhere else. So yeah, it's interesting. So do you use loggers or anything like that?
It's kind of whatever they have, and we will go to that later. But first, my big thing is I want them to have this, look at the whiteboard, have the three things to do. I want to do the track map immediately. And for me, I think the big key with the track map is that it has to be done right away. And the key is that they do the track map before they talk to anybody or anybody talks to them. And that's kind of difficult sometimes to implement. If you're there with one club racer guy and he's alone, and he just decides, yeah, okay, I'm going to give this a try, that's one thing. But if you're with a group of folks or a prep shop and they've got a way to do it, and they're used to doing it, you have to kind of convince everybody that this is going to provide clearer information, both to the driver, and then the driver can provide more clear input to whoever's going to make the adjustments on the car. But it's something that I think is a real key. And some people do it right away, and some people you really need to work to do that. But what happens oftentimes is the driver, has got a couple of people around him professionally or informally, and they're excited to be at the races. They're excited to be at the track. They've got significant input into the process, and they didn't get to drive the damn car, and they want to know, how was it out there? Was this better? Did you like this? How was the track? Did you see this? What about? And so I think the brain automatically switches gears from remembering things clearly to, oh, this person is asking me a question and I need to kind of adjust. It happens so quickly, but you're adjusting your thoughts to, what does this other person want, need, or what's their level of, expertise and all that kind of stuff. And I think that it's a huge interference with the process. And I likened it to, if you wake up in the morning and you have a crazy dream, you might be able, if you're interested, you might be able to kind of work it back a page or two. But if your wife comes in and turns on the lights and says, good morning, there's not a trace of that dream left. It's vanished. I tell people, I'm not smart enough to know neurologically if this is the same thing that's happening, but I do know from doing this myself when I raced that unless I did it right away, I didn't retain it nearly as well. But rather, I would find myself guessing, or even worse, trying to, you find yourself kind of making stuff up. And that's really not good. So sometimes I will ask a group or a couple of folks that are helping with the car, I'll ask them, what's the worst question you could ask a driver right after a session? And they'll be thinking about that for a while. And I'll say, any question. He's got to have that moment, or she, but it's got to be immediate.
Well, there's two things to that. And it sort of leads back to what you said earlier about preparation for the session as well. So if you've got some objectives for your session, so imagine you don't do anything. What ends up happening is you go out and you drive around in a circle and you have fun and you come back in and you don't really know which way's up, and it's like it's all kind of interesting. But then if you go into it with a bit more proactive, saying like, what are my three goals for the session, which is your tip here from before, and then you've got that time to reflect. So I can't remember who it was, but we had someone else on the show and they were saying the way in which I work with the drivers is basically the session, you might have come into the pits, but the session is not over until you've done your feedback session and you filled your track map. And I don't know if they actually give it to them in the car when they're still sat and belted in, you know, here's a pen, here's a piece of paper, write down your notes before you've even had a chance to talk to anyone. In practical terms, that's not always possible, but that's the kind of idea that they're trying to do. It's like your session hasn't finished. You might be in the pits, but your session hasn't finished until you've written everything down that's in your head. And, you know, from your own stimulation and not from necessarily having questions asked. If you do have help, again, you know, there are different ways of doing that. So people can take you through a prompt, you know, what was the one corner that was holding you back kind of thing. And that does tend to unlock the mind a little bit. But I think you're really right in saying you want to get that raw feeling and emotion without any confusion. I mean, sometimes you might feel something with the car, and I had a situation recently with the brakes, and he came in and it was like, oh, these brakes are definitely, they're doing something unusual. And then you start getting chatted to people about it, and then they're like, oh no, the brake's fine. And so then you're like, oh, so as a driver, that's kind of undermines where your confidence and all that sort of stuff. So you just got to think through it in terms of the feedback and the questioning, so that you get that stuff captured down so that, well, if it was real in your head, then it was real.
Yeah, see, I agree with that strongly. I've had situations where people will start to tell the driver that that wasn't what was happening. Or I've had experiences with drivers who have had prior interactions with people who probably meant to be helpful, but basically were kind of shutting them down and denying what they were saying. And if the driver feels something was happening, even if he's wrong, it's got to be addressed, because that's what he feels is happening. And the next time the car is out there running around, it's not going to be somebody in the paddock whose ass is at risk. It's that person who's driving the car. And that's got to be addressed. So I think the big deal is I give them, you know, it doesn't need to be a perfect track map, but I'll, you know, number it, you know, here's the session, you know, and as soon as they can do it, they just take a pen and just go around the damn track map and just puke down some thoughts. A big piece of this, I think, is that you establish trust between yourself and the driver. The driver is never going to say something that he's going to feel is silly. Don't worry about vocabulary. You can say anything, and I'm not going to repeat that to anybody. You're not going to be made fun of in any way. I can remember being in these situations where I would get out of the car and not be able to, you know, have great difficulty trying to assess what was happening. I tell people sometimes it's like, you know, the drunk who fell down the staircase and somebody at the bottom is saying, okay, tell us which steps you bounced off of. He doesn't know that. All he knows is that he's at the bottom. And sometimes the driver feels that way. And rather than them making anything up, I want them to be able to say, I think it's doing something, and maybe they can't articulate it perfectly, but that's something that we'll work towards.
What tips have you got for drivers who, to give that kind of feedback if they are unsure? Because maybe they feel as if they need to translate it in kind of engineering terms and this language like understeer and oversteer and all that sort of stuff. What would you say to them if they're unsure about what's going on? How would you help them to articulate what they're feeling with some confidence?
Yeah, well, it gets gradually better as the driver develops a sense of trust that this, you know, one-on-one interaction in private. Well, I think that's important too, that it be in private. So there's not somebody looming over their shoulders making a judgment on their, you know, ability to articulate something, because it gets better over time. And I think that that's an important piece for the driver to understand, that the first time they do a track map, it may be difficult for them, and it will be difficult for them, and that drivers will get better at each time they do it. Like, I think that one of the big pluses of doing the track map on a routine, and routine is telling you, this is the only thing I'm going to bust your chops about. I'm going to give you this clipboard. I'm going to give you this clipboard every damn time. And part of the brain, I think, realizes like, oh, the next time they get in the car, they realize, yeah, Jim's going to hand me the damn clipboard. And it like activates a portion of the brain that says, oh, you want us to remember this stuff. Okay, we'll work on that. We can do that. And it gradually gets better and better. And it's similar to the driving itself, where nobody expects the driver to be perfect the first time he goes out and runs laps. That would be crazy. Well, nobody should expect the driver to be able to talk about all this stuff the first time he's trying to do it. But as you get, you know, more experienced at it, and if you trust that you're not going to be made fun of, then there's like, okay, we're all in this together and we're trying to work this out, and I'm going to remember different pieces and it's going to come to me a little bit at a time.
You've touched on that sort of concept a couple of times in terms of that support and having someone in your team, and basically you're not going to be made fun of, and that's going to give people, you leave the combat stuff on the track, and then a little bit more open conversation and less judgmental off the track, because at the end of the day, everyone is trying to pull in the same direction and go quicker.
I did have a driver just a few weeks ago, Nathan Bird, who impressed me because we had never met one another before these two Florida races. I had sent him an article I had written for Ross Bentley's Speed Secrets pieces on track maps. And so I had sent that to him. So he had read that apparently, and he did these track maps like as well as I've ever seen. And on one occasion, after finishing well at Sebring, he won his class. He sprinted back from impound to get to my VM to get the clipboard out. And by the time I got to him, he was back at the car, and he had the clipboard sitting on the nose of this F1000 car. He was doing his track map while everybody else was buzzing around talking about, you know, the race. And I remember he said to me, I don't want to forget anything. I thought, like, God, I tell you, you're warming my heart, man. You know, this is exactly what I am shooting for. He didn't care about talking to people afterwards. He wanted to download his brain. And every single time before he got in the car to go out for another session, he would ask for the clipboard and look at the track map that he and I had gone over. And he would do the track map relentlessly, and I wouldn't say anything. And then when he was finished with the track map, I would say, take me around, and he would talk me through. And sometimes I would underline things or make, you know, clarifications that would make it easy for him to go back to that, you know, paragraph that he had written about turn 17. And, you know, connected to a few actionable words. And every time he got in the car, he would ask for the clipboard. And before he'd go out, he would do a review of that.
That's wonderful. You actually answered my question that was the last one that I had on the list here, which was, you know, what do you look for in a driver? And that seems to encapsulate everything, to be honest. So if you could leave us with like one or two thoughts, what would you say that would sort of sum that up? We've talked about the driver, and we've talked about the way in which they can kind of approach racing, looking to progress, looking to sort of having that support around. If you look at the drivers in the paddock, I mean, you've been in a few paddocks now. So what is it that you think would be really valuable for people to think about? Like one, you know, when next time they're in, you know, there, I don't know, what's one thing that they could do perhaps that you see a lot of people not do?
You know, I think they need to be realistic about where they are. I think that a lot of times the club racer is going to race 6 to 8 to 10 times a year. And it's unrealistic for that same racer to feel like he should have the experience as if he was running 25 times a year. I think that they need to be honest with where they stand and progress, you know, from there. One of my big mentors was Bill Noble, who is a Formula V champion. And he would use this phrase from time to time, don't lie to your mind, which I loved. I think what he was saying is that you can't just decide to do something because you think you'd like to do it. You have to be brutally honest with where am I right now? And how can I get a little bit better? And damn it, you know, nobody's got a gun to my head. I've decided to do this incredible activity, and it's great. It's great. I'm just so thrilled that I'm able to do this and to do it with a reasonable goal and a happy state of mind, I mean, that's the person who's going to perform a little bit better. And the person who's most likely to make another gain is the person who just made a little gain, and they understand exactly where that gain came from. Then they own that gain. And, you know, we're all racehorses or we wouldn't be doing this stuff. Their immediate response is, I want to get a little bit more. And if they're making little gains like that and understanding where it comes from, that to me, that's the key. And the recollection piece, the track map, to me is the window that opens that. If the driver understands a little bit more about what's going on here, they feel a little bit more secure about, you know, going for it. And I don't think somebody should be going for it until they're ready.
That's absolutely wonderful. I think what a lovely way to summarize everything. That little thought there you said about the person who's making the little gain is more likely to make another little gain. And that's another super positive way. It's almost like a little virtuous circle, isn't it? Where you just, it just starts a little bit of momentum. Oh, it's absolutely great. Look, Jim, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been fascinating. And, you know, I really wish you all the best. Where can people find you online if they want to follow up and ask you any questions or anything?
The easiest thing to do is to just go to the website, www.carneykdd.com.
I'll put a link in the bottom for you, no problem. Look, thank you so much. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I think I realized that at some point somebody has told me that I coach a little differently. I didn't set out to be a different kind of coach. You know, I just kind of set out like for, you know, what can I do to be most helpful? You know, really, that's, I don't really have an agenda, but rather I'm keying off what the driver tells me and, you know, of course, to a certain extent, stuff that I see.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you very much. Well, what did you think about that? Jim clearly has a wealth of experience coaching amateur drivers. I hope you've got a lot out of listening to his stories, tips, and processes. Adding a track map and feedback to your routine is not always easy, but surely you'll benefit enormously. I really hope you got as much out of this show as I did. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and visit us at yourdatadriven.com.